White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. It is June 6, 2013, and we are again in between two chapters tonight, finishing chapter 44 and going on to chapter 45. I am Carolyn Yeager, and
I'm Hadding Scott.
Okay, and we're going to first complete chapter 44, Are the Jews Victims or Persecutors? Which finishes up the strong case of Jewish attacks on Christianity in America, insisting that they have the superior religion. The Jews do, that is, insist they have the superior religion. Isn't that about right, Hattie?
Could you say that again?
They said, I'm hearing myself come back, but are the Jews victims? We're finishing up the strong case of Jewish attacks on Christianity in America, insisting they have the superior religion.
Okay, you asked me, is that right, Hattie? I should have just said, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, right. See, you're not paying attention to me while I'm talking. That's what that shows.
Didn't hear it
very
well.
You're just waiting to read. All right, so let's finish up this chapter on Are Jews Victims or Persecutors, okay?
All right, well, we left off. I'll just read this last paragraph again that we left off with. And so, when they said, reading the Bible is sheer proselytizing, it isn't fair, the non-Jew, who wanted to prove that he is fair and unprejudiced above all things, a weakness the Jews know how to manipulate, said, well then, out goes the Bible. And it went out. Very well, what next? You must abolish Christmas, too. You must not keep Easter, Jews don't like it. It is anti-Semitic to observe Good Friday. In other words, to please the sensitive Jewish natures, we must eradicate from Christian civilization all that is Christian in it. In the meantime, what transpires?
Are you on chapter 44?
I think that's it.
Because we had two chapters on, let me go back, because it seems like this is taking too long. Because it should start where we ended off. No Jew, says the American Israelite, will conceal his gratification. You're in chapter 43.
Maybe. All right, start reading and I'll catch up.
Okay. We say, no Jew, says the American Israelite, will conceal his gratification when he finds Christians virtually admitting that liberal Christianity is practically an acceptance of the doctrine of liberal Judaism. Unfortunately, this is true. Liberal Christianity and liberal Judaism meet, but only by the surrender of all that is distinctively Christian in doctrine. A liberal Christian is more Jewish than Christian. The statement may sound harsh and arouse resentment, but it is a very simple matter for any liberal Christian to convince himself of this by reading the volume of liberal Jewish doctrine put out by Kaufman Kohler, president of the Hebrew Union College. Liberalism is the funnel by which Christianity is expected to run into Judaism, just as liberalism, so-called in other departments of life, is expected to bring about certain other Jewish aims. You know, liberal Protestantism is, that's very true of that. Well, I've thought that for quite a while. Did you find your place now?
No. I don't know where this is.
Okay. Liberalism in Jewish thought means a wide open country in every way. Judaism has opposed every significant reform that has come to the country. Prohibition, Sunday decency, movie and stage regeneration, and community reverence for sacred things. Judaism has been the prop of the liquor traffic, Sunday desecration, movie and stage excesses, and public contempt for the sacred things of the prevailing religion. And it is all too evident that the Jewish propaganda has made serious inroads everywhere. A congregational church in New Jersey decided to abandon the Bible in some of its classes and substitute sociology, politics, municipal government, and kindred subjects for study. And the Jewish press hailed it as another sign that the church was, quote, in a fair way to adopt what is in substance American Judaism, unquote. In St. Louis, a clergyman, instead of preaching sermons, began to act out moralistic dramas, which he himself had written. And the Jewish press again hailed it as a sign of the dissatisfaction of the Christian within his church. Everything done in every branch of the Christian church has been closely watched, and wherever departure occurred from the distinctly Christian position, it was extravagantly applauded. And wherever loyalty to the landmarks appeared, it was just as extravagantly condemned. Judaism does not wish the Christian church to remain Christian. This accounts for destructive higher criticism, and that's in capital letters, higher criticism, being almost exclusively the work of Jews, although the world has long known them under the guise of German critics.
Okay, so, I got it.
Yeah, okay. So this is interesting, though. There's church and religious criticism, they call it now, higher criticism. Yeah, that goes on. It's supposed to be scholarly and so on. And they call these German, it's always amongst the Germans. German Jews who got real heavily into religious study and Hebrew studies and all of that, and then they made it into something respectable in academia, and they're all Jews really for the most part. So,
well, I think it may be the case that the Germans come up with some ideas and interpretations that are complex enough that it's easier for Jews to twist and misrepresent them into something else. Mm-hmm. You know, like you have the relationship between Marx and Hegel, mm-hmm. right? Marx takes certain aspects of Hegel and does something completely different with them, and it gives his system, a slight air of respectability that it otherwise might not have.
Well, right, but it was in Germany in the 1800s sometime, maybe it even started a little earlier, but probably not until then, that this the Jews managed to get into to become respected scholars in religious, in church circles and so on, in church scholarship, because it was like, okay, that's a legitimate area of study, Hebrewism and Israelism and, you know, all the history of all that and so on. And it was the Germans who, it was in Germany, I would say, I guess it was the Germans that allowed that to happen. And from there on, boy, they've never stopped, have they?
All right. Okay. Jewish intolerance today, yesterday, and in every age of history where Jews were able to exert influence or power is indisputable, except among people who do not know the record. Jewish intolerance in the past is a matter of history. For the future, it is a matter of Jewish prophecy. One of the strongest causes militating against the full Americanization of several millions of Jews in this country is their belief, instilled in them by their religious authorities, that they are chosen, that this land is theirs, that the inhabitants are idolaters, that the day is coming when the Jews will be supreme. How can they otherwise act than in agreement with such declarations? You can see what is meant if you read Jewish articles describing the shoving aside of the New England people by the Jews, the supercilious attitude adopted toward the stock that made America is merely a foreshadowing of what would be the complete attitude if power and influence made it possible.
Boy, that's true. Go ahead, sorry.
Bolshevism, which began with the destruction of the class that contained all the promise of a better Russia, is an exact parallel for the attitude that is adopted in this country regarding the original stock. We are not permitted by the Jews to sing the battle hymn of the Republic in our schools, because one of the stanzas has a Christian flavor. The Jews claim that the presence of one Jewish child in an assembly of children ought, in fairness, to prevent the singing of that historic song. Yeah. Norman Hapgood, writing in a Jewish publication, said, "I need hardly explain that I do not think Jews ought to insist overmuch on their rights or nationality in a negative sense. They ought to be as much Jews as they can, but ought to be as little as possible of what is merely anti-Christian. For the Jews to try to get a song out of the public schools because it praises Jesus is perhaps natural, but hardly wise." Mr. Hapgood received a lot of abuse for his well-conceived counsel. Again, we come to the end of our space with the record hardly scratched. Sufficient has been presented to show the strong, unceasing anti-Christian activity of the Jews in the United States. Had the Jewish press been read extensively by non-Jews during the last 15 years, this present series of articles would have been unnecessary. The people would have known the facts. It is to present some of the facts that are illustrated in the Jewish press along the line of religious intolerance that these two articles have been written. Jewish spokesmen plead for suppression of facts in the name of religious tolerance, and they denounce exposure of the facts as being religious persecution. Read the whole non-Jewish religious and secular publications, and you will not find 1/100,000th part of the animosity against the Jewish religion which is found in the Jewish press. In the Jewish press, continuously found week after week for long years, against the Christian religion. The present writer has never seen nor heard of an article attacking the Jews' religion. So, once for all, in spiking the cry of religious persecution, we show that it exists in quantity and strength among the Jews. Nowhere else. No one imbued with the American spirit would or could condemn, hinder, or even remonstrate with any person on account of the faith he holds. As to religious prejudice or persecution entering into the present series of articles, there they are, reprinted in booklet form for permanent examination. Where is the prejudice or persecution? Cite the page. Jewish spokesmen would use their energy to better advantage and more to the honor of the Jewish people if they would address themselves to what is in the articles rather than to what is not in them. The statements made by the Dearborn Independent have been voluminously discussed, but they are still awaiting an answer.
Well, okay, so there was two chapters on this religion problem with the Jews and how they want to, as I said in the beginning, insert their religion as the religion of the United States. And they say here at the end that Jews basically comes down to that Jews do not have the American spirit. Now, there was an American spirit at one time, and obviously the Ford people thought it still existed, but I don't know what the American spirit is right now. It seems to be totally, you know, corrupted. But Jews never did have it and never wanted to have it and have always been trying to put their spirit in its place. That's basically what's going on here. And they do that, one way they do that, they thought was important, was to get rid of their predominance of Christianity in the society. So now we're going from Christianity to baseball. Next two chapters are about what the Jews did to American baseball. It's the same kind of Americanism that they're attacking, right, Hattie?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and there's this little, this is chapter 45, there's this little quote that begins it. You want to read that first? I think it's a very good one.
All right. But it's a quote attributed to Herbert Adams Gibbons in The Century, which was a magazine, of September 1921, I suppose, page 789. This clannishness would eventually break down were it not for the deliberate efforts of Jewish leaders who are determined that Israel shall remain an imperium in imperio. If the Jews persist in maintaining a distinct ethnic consciousness and an exclusive community life, anti-Semitism will thrive in America as it has thrived in Europe. The American nation, itself the result of fusion, will not tolerate without protest a foreign element in it.
Well, there's all in a nutshell, isn't it? You know, so many wise things were said. And, you know, they bring them up all the time. This guy was good. The deliberate efforts of Jewish leaders who are determined that Israel shall remain an imperium. And that's why they want to keep that clannishness going amongst all their people, to keep that going. All right, very good.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of things that could be said about that. In the first place, the United States, the American population up to that point was not that much of a fusion. It was you had Anglo-Saxons and a few Celts and Germans who were related to Anglo-Saxons. And, you know, so it was all pretty much all Northwest European.
Right.
Another thing is that this kind of intolerance of a nation within a nation is something that developed during the First World War. Because up till that time, Germans, people who spoke German at home, they could have their children educated in a German language public school. There were bilingual schools, for example, in Cincinnati, Ohio, that were German and English. German was very widely spoken, and there was big German publishing in Milwaukee and St. Louis. The same thing is true of the Cajun French. They had French. They could speak French in school in Louisiana. Southern Louisiana, and all of that was wiped out pretty much after the First World War. It started during the First World War because they got the idea that having people with any kind of foreign identification was a security risk to the country as a whole. And so the French and the Germans were put under heavy pressure to give up their languages. Mm-hmm. But the Jews... You know, the Jews had ways to continue their separate identity. Of course, they had their Jewish schools, which formally are religious schools, but they're really racial schools.
Yeah, they sent their kids to a Jewish religious school, separate from, you know, along with the regular public schools. And in those schools, they learned all this Jew stuff and how different and superior they were, and so on.
Cultivate their ethnic identity and their separateness.
Right. Okay.
So, let's see here. Chapter 45. Jewish gamblers corrupt American baseball. There are men in the United States who say that baseball has received its death wound and is slowly dying out of the list of respectable sports. There are other men who say that American baseball can be saved if a clean sweep is made of the Jewish influence, which has just dragged it through a period of bitter shame and demoralization. Whether baseball as a first-class sport is killed and will survive only as a cheap jack entertainment, or whether baseball possesses sufficient intrinsic character to rise in righteous wrath and cast out the danger that menaces it, will remain a matter of various opinion. But there is one certainty, namely, that the last and most dangerous blow dealt baseball was curiously notable for its Jewish character. Yet only lesser Jews were indicted. Inevitably, the names of other Jews appeared in the press accounts, and people wondered who they were. A Jewish judge presided. Jewish lawyers were prominent on both sides of the cases. Numerous strange things occurred. But strangest of all is the fact that although American fans felt that something epical had happened in baseball, few really know what it was. There has been time enough for others to tell the truth if they were so disposed. Many sports editors have come as near telling it as their newspapers would permit them. But it becomes daily more evident that if the whole matter is to be laid bare, so that Americans may know where to look for danger, the Dearborn Independent will have to do it. And this is not our own choosing. Baseball is a trivial matter compared with some of the facts that are awaiting publication. Yet it is possible to see the operation of the Jewish idea in baseball as clearly as any other field. The process is the same, whether in war or politics, in finance or in sports. To begin with, Jews are not sportsmen. This is not set down in complaint against them, but merely as analysis. It may be a defect in their character, or it may not. It is nevertheless a fact which discriminating Jews unhesitatingly acknowledge. Whether this is due to their physical lethargy, their dislike of unnecessary physical action, or their serious cast of mind, others may decide. The Jew is not naturally an out-of-door sportsman. If he takes up golf, it is because his station in society calls for it, not that he really likes it, and if he goes in for collegiate athletics, as some of the younger Jews are doing, it is because so much attention has been called to their neglect of the sports that the younger generation thinks it necessary to remove that occasion of remark. And yet, the bane of American sports today is the presence of a certain type of Jew, not as a participant, but as an exploiter and corrupter. If he had been a sportsman for the love of sport, he might have been saved from becoming an exploiter and corrupter. For there is no mind to which the corrupting of a sport is more illogical and even unexplainable than the mind of the man who participates in it. There will be a full case made out in justification of the use of the above terms, exploiter and corrupter, with regard to baseball. But it would be just as easy to make out the same sort of case with regard to wrestling and horse racing. Wrestling is so completely ruled by Jews as to have become an outlawed sport. The story of wrestling is not only the story of the demoralization of a sport, but also the story of the wholesale bunkoing of the public. And there's a bit of a bit of an anachronism here for current readers. Today, people will say, well, of course wrestling is fake. Everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. Because Vince McMahon, back in the 80s, came out and said that his wrestling company was just putting on entertainment. But before then, I remember, I think in the 70s, it was, some people still thought it was real. At least officially, they denied that it was fake. They pretended it was real. And, you know, if you go back a few decades, probably a lot of people thought it was real.
Well, yeah. Well, this is, yeah, 1921, they're already saying that it's fake. But there must have been a time when wrestling was real. I mean, there is a real kind of wrestling. They have wrestling in the Olympics and so on. But as a spectator sport, I guess, it kind of lost its appeal unless it was this hyped up, you know, entertainment type stuff. Yeah. And ever since there's been television, it seems like that's, you know, it's been one of those weird things on television. It's too bad. Well, it's just, it shows that they've done this. This has happened to everything. Everything has been turned into a fart. You know, it's corrupt on the inside. It's not what it pretends to be.
The same is true of horse racing. The whole atmosphere of this sport has been tinged with dishonesty. The horses remain almost the only well-bred creatures connected with it. Yet why should the art of breeding and training and testing fine horses be debasing? Only because a certain class saw in it a chance to play upon the weaknesses of men for the sake of gain. That, indeed, explains the presence of the Jew in modern sports, and it also explains why the Jewish idea in sport, instead of being preservative, is corruptive. The Jew saw money where the sportsman saw fun and skill. The Jew set out to capitalize rivalry and to commercialize contestant zeal. This is not necessarily the only course the Jew could have taken with regard to sports, but it is the course that he most notably has taken. And as scandal follows scandal, it would seem to be high time that organized Jewry should undertake to control or repudiate those Jews who have been most instrumental in corrupting and nearly destroying our cleanest, most manly public sports.
I like that. Most manly public sports, yeah. Really?
Well, there he is asking for the good Jews to try to solve the problem again.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I noticed that, too. Yeah, again, you know, it's never... Well, we know now that's never going to happen. They had to pretend... They might have known that, but they had to pretend that... That they saw these people as being able to change. And people have to do that today, Hadding. If you're one of those people who say, well, the Jews are biologically whatever and they're never gonna, you know, there's no hope for them, so we have to deal with them in that, under that understanding, oh, people get all upset with that. Still, it's not acceptable.
It is worth noting that in Chicago, where the Jewish Anti-Defamation League has its headquarters, there was not a word of reproof sent out from Jews to the Jewish culprits, chiding them for their activities. Not a word. But at the same time, the pressure of the Anti-Defamation League was heavy on the whole American newspaper press to prevent the public statement that the whole baseball scandal was a Jewish performance from end to end. Baseball had a close call for its life back in 1875. Rowdyism, gambling, drinking, and general disorderliness on the baseball fields brought the sport very low in public estimation, so low that attendance at the games fell heavily. In this year, 1921, there is another public rebuke being administered baseball, by the same means, a very heavy reduction of public support in attendance at the games. My mind was wandering while I was reading.
Yeah. You know, this is interesting, though, that, you know, back in, they're using the year 1875, all these people in these sports, not all of them, but, you know, a lot of them, they were hard-drinking, rowdy, you know, guys, disorderly and so on. And it was these managers who wanted to make money off the sports, probably, who worked hard to clean it up and to tell these guys they needed to behave themselves so that they would be models for the American people and the American people would want to follow them and, you know, pay them better salaries and so on. So, you know, that there was, it wasn't all just that they were all such fine, manly men, but then they went, took that to the next, to a further extreme and made it into something that was just for making money for the insiders. Okay.
The storm began to be heard as far back as 1919. The Cincinnati Nationals had defeated the Chicago Americans in the World Series of that year, and he's referring to the National League and the American League. And immediately thereafter, the country became a whispering gallery, wherein were heard mysterious rumors of crooked dealing. The names of Jews were heard then, but it meant nothing to the average man. The rumors dealt with shady financial gains for a number of Jew gamblers of decidedly shady reputation. But they got away with it in the parlance of the field. There was not enough public indignation to force a showdown, and too many interests were involved to prevent baseball being given a black eye in full view of an adoring public. However, not everyone forgot the incident. Some, who had the interest of honest sport at heart, and a regard for facts as well, kept on the trail. Long after the trail grew cold, long after the principal wrongdoers forgot their early caution. Where money had once been taken successfully, the gang would be sure to return. Time went on until the 1920 season began to wane. One day when the Chicago and Philadelphia National League teams were engaged in a series at Chicago, strange messages began to reach the office of the Chicago club. The messages were dated from Detroit and informed the Chicago club and management that several well-known Jews were betting heavily on Philadelphia. The bets involved large sums of money, and as the contest was only the ordinary run of daily game, not an important contest at all, the unusual interest of Jewish plungers attracted attention. At the same time, it was observed that money began rolling into the pool rooms on Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia.
Chicago club officials called a hasty conference on receipt of the messages. They called in Grover Cleveland Alexander, explained the situation to him, and told him it was up to him to save the game. It was not Alexander's turn to pitch, Claude R. Hendricks having been chosen for that day. Neither was Alexander in training to pitch that day. However, he did go to the box, and although he hurled his heart out to beat Philadelphia and thwart the Jew gamblers, he failed. Then came the big scandal. A Cook County grand jury was called into session at Chicago and asked to investigate. When this grand jury had completed its labors, 8 members of the Chicago American League team were under indictment for throwing the World Series of 1919, the previous year, to the Cincinnati Reds. And all along the line of the investigation, the names of Jews were plentifully sprinkled. It was discovered that the indictment brought by the first grand jury were faulty. A second one was called, and it was under the second group of indictments that the famous trial at Chicago was held. One difference in the work of the 2 grand juries was that the second indicted 5 Jews who had escaped the first one. 2 of these men were Carl Zork and Benny Franklin. Oh, Benjamin Franklin, who were just as much implicated at the time of the first grand jury as the second, but the prosecutor's office did not try to secure their indictment. Why? Because Riplogel, the attorney representing the prosecution, said there were enough men indicted without Zork and Franklin. These 2 St. Louis Jews were represented by Alfred S. Austrian, a Jewish lawyer of Chicago. This second grand jury also indicted Ben and Louis Levy and their brother-in-law, D.A. Zeltser, gamblers from Des Moines. their indictment was not secured at the first grand jury investigation directed by Riplogle, assistant to Hoyne, who was then acting for the state of Illinois. Between the first and second grand juries, a political change had occurred, and the public interests in the second grand jury were in the care of a new prosecuting attorney, Robert Crow, a former judge. It became necessary at this point in the narrative to give a brief who's who of the baseball scandal, omitting from the list the names of the baseball players, who are sufficiently known to the public. This list will comprise only those who have been in the background of baseball, and whom it is necessary to know in order to understand what has been happening behind the scenes in recent years. For the first, let us name Alfred D. Lasker. He is a member of the American Jewish Committee, was recently appointed by President Harding to be chairman of the United States Shipping Board.
How do you like that?
Yeah. I wonder if he can help his buddies on the United States Shipping Board. And is known as the author of The Lasker Plan, a widely heralded plan for the reorganization of baseball, which practically took the sport out of non-Jewish control. He is reputed to be the second richest Jew in Chicago and was head of the advertising agency which became famous under the Gentile names of Lord and Thomas. Moreover, he is a heavy stockholder in the Chicago Cubs, the Chicago National League team. The so-called Lasker Plan has been attributed to Mr. Lasker, although it is not here intimated that he has specifically claimed to be its originator. The intimation is not made for the reason that to do so might be putting Mr. Lasker in the position of claiming what is not true. Until he makes the claim, the term Lasker Plan must remain merely a designation and not a description of its origin. This matter brings us to the name of Alfred S. Austrian, a Jewish lawyer of Chicago, who is a warm friend both of Mr. Lasker and of the Riplogle aforementioned. It is said that Mr. Austrian was really the originator of the Lasker Plan, which for certain reasons was handed to Mr. Lasker, who was not averse to publicity and who knew the art of self-advertising. Now, it appears that Austrian was also the legal representative of Charles A. Comiskey, the owner of the Chicago American League team, and that he was also, if he is not now, the legal advisor of William Veeck, president of the Chicago National League Club, in which it has just been said that Lasker is a heavy stockholder. It was this club which was touched by the questionable game of August 1920, and which afterward released Hendricks, the pitcher chosen for and withdrawn from that game. The Chicago National League Club has never explained why it released Hendricks, and he has never demanded redress.
Well, he was probably paid off, too.
Yeah. Mr. Austrian's further activities will appear when the narrative of the investigation and trial is resumed. Then there is Arnold Rothstein.
Rothstein. Oh, I don't know why people pronounce it that way. Well, it's not right.
It's a usual Jewish way of pronouncing this.
I don't know if the Jews do it that way. Do they?
It's Frankenstein.
It's this Stein thing is wrong. It should be Stein. Anyway,
well, if they spoke proper German, it would be. Then there is Arnold Rothstein, a Jew. Well, that's redundant. Who describes himself as being in the real estate business, but who is known to be a wealthy gambler, owner of a notorious gambling house at Saratoga, a racetrack owner, and is reputed to be financially interested in the New York National League Club. Rothstein was usually referred to during the baseball scandal as the man higher up. It is stated that in some manner unknown, he received the secret testimony given before the grand jury and offered it to a New York newspaper. However, the fact is this. The grand jury testimony disappeared from the prosecuting attorney's safekeeping. It is stated that, when Rothstein found out it did not incriminate him, he then offered it for publicity purposes. The price which it is said to have cost is also stated. It is further stated that the New York paper to whom the secret stolen testimony was offered, in turn offered its use for a larger sum to a Chicago newspaper, and that the Chicago newspaper, to protect itself, called up Robert Crow, the new prosecutor, who advised that in printing it, the newspaper would incur an unpleasant risk. Other Chicago editors were warned, and the testimony was not printed. Even the New York newspaper thought better of it and did not print it. In this connection, Rothstein threatened suit against Ban Johnson of the National Commission, the big-bodied, big-minded, honest director and protector of straight baseball. But the suit, like others of the kind, has not been brought. Rothstein is known on Broadway as a slick Jew. That he is powerful with the authorities has often been demonstrated.
His money in the palm, that's how he gets his power, with the authorities.
His operations on the turf have led to suggestions that he be ruled off. Alfred S. Austrian, herein before mentioned, was the legal advisor of Rothstein during the baseball scandal. Hugh S. Fullerton, the able sport writer of the New York Evening Mail, writing on July 28, 1921, made a plea that a person guilty of crooked work on a racetrack should be expelled not only from the racetrack but from ballparks, tennis courts, football fields, and every place else where sport is promoted. These sport spoilers must be barred from every sport. And in the same paper, referring specifically to Rothstein, Mr. Fullerton writes, "There is in New York a gambler named Rothstein who is much feared and much accursed. His name has been used in connection with almost every big thieving crooked deal on the racetrack, and he is openly named in this baseball scandal. There has been no legal proof advanced against him, beyond the fact that he is the only man in the entire crowd who had enough money to handle such a deal. At least $200,000 was used in actual cash, and no one concerned could command that much money except Rothstein, who is either the vilest crook or the most abused man in America. Rothstein sits in the box with the owner of the New York Giants. He has the entree to the exclusive clubhouses on racetracks. He is prominent at fights." Then, after naming Abe Attell and Benny Koff, who also enjoy exceptional privileges around the New York club, Mr. Fullerton makes his plea for the exclusion of sport spoilers from every ground where sport is promoted.
So this Hugh Fullerton was a good guy, not a Jew, and he was a sports writer of one of the New York newspapers at the time. They weren't all Jews then. And, he was arguing for clean sports. I don't know what would happen today, but everybody's so used to all this stuff. And all the papers are Jewish, under Jewish domination now. And of course, it's not just newspapers. But newspapers were big at that time, very big.
Well, you know what? It says Jewish gamblers, but when the game is fixed, that's not really gambling.
Yeah, but it's because they gamble on it that they want to fix it, so they can. Well,
because there is gambling, Jews have a way to participate in it that is not gambling. You see,
okay.
It's just like insider trading on the stock market, mm-hmm. right? People who invest money on the stock market without knowing much about the stock, they're gambling basically. But if somebody has inside information about stuff that's going to happen, that person is not really gambling.
True.
A lot of Jews got convicted of insider trading.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the 80s.
Well, they're still doing it.
Oh, of course they are. They're just more careful, probably. You have to be, I think, a little bit reckless or annoy somebody that has your information to get caught and stuff like that, I think. Then there is Charles A. Comiskey, who is one of the most impressive examples in the country today of a good Irishman being entirely eclipsed by a Jew.
Is that supposed to be funny, that calling Comiskey an Irishman, or is that somehow a Jew, an Irish name? I was thinking it was
no. If you look at
Polish
the rest
name,
of what he says here, Comiskey is actually considered a good guy.
Oh yeah, I know, but I mean. Is he Irish? Is that an Irish name, Comiskey?
Evidently.
Could be. I just realized. I was thinking, oh, that's like a Polish name, but it's not. It's not spelled right for a Polish
yeah.
name. Right, okay.
Comiskey was one of the staunchest supporters of honest baseball in this country, and he gave great assistance in erecting the major league game to the position it occupied just before the scandal. He used his best endeavors, also, to get the truth about the throwing of the World Series by his men. But his efforts were thwarted, and even he, perhaps, has not the ghost of a suspicion how it was done. So
yeah, well,
that,
you know, just to mention that this Comiskey, that's what Comiskey Park in Chicago was named after him, must be. And that was a big baseball park. I don't know if it may have been rebuilt or something, but it's probably still called Comiskey Park. One of the big places where, I don't know, it was which league, but the baseball games were played in. Okay, that's all. You're not
so
familiar
that,
with Comiskey Park, huh, Hattie?
No.
Oh, I'm from around that area. So
I passed through Chicago very briefly once.
Yeah, well, you have, like, if you lived around there, you know, grew up around there, you certainly heard about Comiskey Park all the time.
Okay. All that I remember from passing through Chicago is a lot of brick structures, red bricks.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
So that, instead of Mr. Comiskey, we look at the Jew behind him, who is Harry Grabiner. With Comiskey in failing health, Grabiner is in charge at Comiskey Park. More than that, he appears to be in charge of Comiskey himself, preventing him from making public statements and otherwise dictating to him, pushing himself forward in a manner that has indelibly and unpleasantly impressed nearly every sport writer in America.
Yeah, it's like with Woodrow Wilson. I mean, how do they get control of all these people that aren't Jews who have a position, you know, that of influence? Amazing.
Well, they do it when they're in failing health or they have some other weakness. It's astounding if you consider how many U.S. presidents we've had that had some kind of serious health problem.
Mm-hmm.
Or,
well, you know, but it shows that these Jews are conspiring. They're aware this is one of their tactics. One of their very big, important tactics, and so they're always watching for who they can get control of.
Yeah,
and you
it's
know,
kind of like
it's conspiracy.
Kind of like moving in on old ladies and taking their money.
True.
Chicago's support of the White Sox began to slump even before the scandal, and it was helped on by the unpopularity of Grabiner's methods, which were wholly characteristic of what the Americanized Jew calls the kikes. the kikes.
I'm surprised to see that almost, but
well, he's saying that
Americanized Jews call themselves
the Americanized Jews. The Americanized Jews, the good Jews.
Oh, the good Jews. Okay.
The good Jews. The good Americanized Jews say those kikes.
Yeah, are making us all look bad, right?
Yeah. As secretary, didn't Abe Foxman say, "Ich bin ein Kike," something like that?
Yeah, I think so.
As secretary of the club, Grabiner has grabbed the headship. And if Comiskey had power enough to unseat him, he would do more than the courts have done to purge the White Sox from its most serious remaining blemish. There are shady spots at Chicago that neither the grand jury nor the court trial brought out, one of which is now related. At all ballparks in the American League, and in the National League, for that matter, officials of the home club, that is, of the club in whose home city the game is being played, take the gate. To take the gate is to collect the tickets and render a report of the attendance. Tickets are designed and numbered for the different gates: box gate, pass gate, grandstand gate, bleacher gate, and the rest. The accounts are made up showing the number of people who passed through each gate. When all the reports are in, it can be seen at a glance what the paid attendance is and the shares of the contesting clubs. In former times, it was the custom for the visiting club to assign a secretary to watch the gates and thus ensure an honest count. But years ago, the honor system was adopted, leaving the entire accounting to the home club, and this honor system was strictly observed. No one suspected cheating. The count was made during the sixth and seventh innings of each day's game, the officials of the home club visiting all the gates, taking the turnstile count and making the record. Three slips were then prepared, showing the home club's share, the visiting club's share, and the grand total. Under Grabiner's regime, the honor system as practiced at the Chicago Park began to be suspected. It began to be mysteriously suggested that visiting teams were not getting their full share. Through a system of false accounting, it was said, money was being held out. Naturally, with all the other secret investigations that were proceeding in baseball, this clue was not left untouched. Detectives were hired. Watchers were stationed. Secret counts were made. Not only one club, nor only two clubs, adopted secret methods of finding out what was occurring under Grabiner's secretaryship. They discovered that the honor system was not in vogue at that park. Their suspicions were confirmed. The mysterious rumors were verified. It would probably be highly objectionable to pro-Jewish persons to mention the Jewish management with these methods. But there are the facts. The White Sox of Comiskey's palmy days have certainly ridden to a sorry finish under the Jewish control that has been foisted upon it. And it is typical, for there is no surer clue by which to trace a certain type of Jew than by the near certainty that even with honest money rolling in upon him, he will try to increase the flow by petty dishonesty, which, once discovered, declasses him forever. It is typical. There is a lure in trickery that appeals to some men more than sound and satisfying achievement does. Think of a world-famous baseball club allowing a system that cheated the guest club of a few hundred admission fees.
Yeah.
Then next in this gallery of notables in the background of baseball is the Jew gambler Abe Attell, whose connection with sports has been of a questionable character ever since his dethronement from his pugilistic pedestal. Attell is known as the king bee of the scheme to throw the game in the World Series. He knows all about underhanded throwing of contests, because he has thrown his own fights, it means he was boxing, now feigning to be beaten when it involved gambling bets and easily winning when the same reasons prompted. Attell is of such a character that he ought to be barred from the grounds of any sport, as Mr. Fullerton suggests. He is the Morris Guest of sports, without Guest's success. All the players named Attell as the fixer. Even Rothstein named Attell as the fixer. It seemed unanimous, with perhaps Attell's own consent, that he should be regarded as the fixer. It made it so much more comfortable for others.
I want to interject here, Hadding, just real quick, that I was looking for pictures, and I came upon this one of the ball players who did engage in throwing games, and he did it a lot, and it's become a known fact, documented, and so on. And that is Hal Chase, a real cute looking guy. I mean, there's a whole bunch of pictures of him up this one website, and boy, I would think he probably had an awful lot of girlfriends, because he's a very appealing looking fellow. But he did, and he admitted it, and I've got some quotes by him. This might fit in better next week. I don't know if I'm going to use this picture now today or wait till next week. I'm going to have to look over what's coming up. But I just wanted to say that you know, there is information on players who did go along with this. You know, they couldn't have done it if the players didn't agree to do it. They did it for money. So.
Yeah. Well, he didn't say, "Satan, get thee behind me."
No, that's right. That's right.
Attell went so far as to say that he approached Rothstein with the proposition to raise a pool to bribe the players to throw the games, but Rothstein declined. And yet, Maharg, another Jew, whose name spelled backward is Graham, says that a telegram came through signed AR, which promised $20,000. The AR was supposed by some to mean Arnold Rothstein, but others say he is too shrewd even to sign his initials. However, it was asserted that 10 gamblers, all Jews, cleaned up $250,000 on the games, and that nearly as much money was used to manage it. That's a lot of money in 1919, $250,000.
Yeah. Really?
About probably 20 times that today.
Yeah, well, so we don't have any time left. Maybe we'll just stop here. There's a little more about Attell, but I don't think you have time to read it. So we're going to complete this next week. We've got because I've got both of them here. The next one is Jewish Degradation of American Baseball. It's about the same length, so possibly we can finish this and do that one. And get it all finished next week with this business about the baseball. Anyway, it's interesting, huh? And
yeah.
So thanks, Hadding, and thanks, listeners, for listening to us tonight, and I hope you come back again next week. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.